It is a fact that some Christians do not want their church to grow. Somehow, they have learned to rationalize their lethargy toward winning the lost to Christ, although with their lips they would deny that they're lethargic. Those believers have designed what Donald McGavern calls a remnant theology, and they take a certain satisfaction in being a minority, despised by unbelievers. Have we ever done that? They consider their unattractiveness a virtue and enjoy being described as separate from the world. I think that's described as pretty well. I prefer Mr. DeCotch's. He gets a little frustrated, and he'll just say, look, he said, you know, he talked about some particular thing being stupid, and he says, look, he said, I don't mind being persecuted. We'll probably be persecuted, but he said, I want to be persecuted for something worthwhile. And that's the way I feel. Yeah, persecute me. Burn me at the stake, whatever, but make it worthwhile. I mean, make it count. I don't want to go down for just being weird for no reason. Okay, I'm sure you feel the same. One of the chief causes for negative attitude on the part of the lay people is that the congregation has become almost like an extended family. And we're even told, learn to be one family. Is that bad? That's good. Is it an unqualified good or a qualified good? It's qualified for this reason. They have grown to know and love each other so much that they feel extremely uncomfortable when an outsider penetrates their inner circle. Try it. Get your neighbor kid whose hair is long and he's unshaven and tell him, come to church. Just come walking in there. I'll give you $20 after sundown. And you be where you can watch, and you just have him come into church and look at the responses. People will look, and they'll get this, and they'll look to see if there's an usher around, and they'll get tighter in their groups, and somebody will go over and, well, hi, you know, and they'll go back to their group, you know. Whew, boy, I did my part, you know. Again, this is often unconscious, but outsiders soon get the message that they are not fully welcome and they will not stay around the church very long under those conditions. We can see this, you know, as a pastor, I've tended to judge the warmth or coldness of my congregation by the roar or lack of. This group obviously is very warm. You can't even hear yourself think. OSHA would shut us down for noise pollution in the States for just our drinky gatherings before dinner. But I like that. You know, that to me, that tells me a congregation is warm. When everybody just kind of quietly filters out the door and mutters around, I say, boy, you know, this congregation's cold. But, you know, I misjudge that. I've had to alter my perception a little bit, because the fact that we may roar among and at each other does not indicate how someone whom God may be drawing will be perceived. I saw this during the feast. I went to a strange congregation. Of course, it was a strange land. But as more of a stranger walking in the door, everything was as it should be. The roar coming out that door before I ever hit it was deafening. These people were having such a wonderful, warm time. I walked in, greeters are there. Greeters are great. Greeters are qualified good, though they can be a real problem. Because, you see, the greeters, as one widow who is mourning the fact that the church, this one church was cold, she says, I go to church. She said, the only one that's talked to me are the deacons at the door, and that's because they have to. And she was right. The congregation happened to be headquarters, PM, that she was describing. And she was right. I don't think it's that way now as much. I was going to say it all, but we still have a little ways to go. Let's put it this way. The deacon won't throw you out for looking a little strange. He'll let you get in and then come get you and throw you out. I better shut up and keep going here. I'm getting myself in trouble. Anyway. So the greeters were at the door, they're extremely warm, made us feel very welcome, you know, hi. Well, you know that's institutional. So you go inside, that's great. And there's people all talking, they've got their groups, you know. And you kind of walk by and people catch your eye and they'll nod and you'll nod and smile. And occasionally someone will turn and say, oh, I'm so-and-so. And that's wonderful. But you know, they can't wait to get back to that conversation. And they want to make you welcome. But they really, deep down, would rather be fellowshipping over here, and it's pretty obvious. And so there's the greetings and there's the showing of what? The introductions and the showing of friendliness, but there is not the incorporation and a feeling of belonging. Now, when God is calling, so that's fine for a visitor. I understand that. It didn't bother me, you know. It just gave me a set of eyes to see and think a little clearer about what someone who is cast loose, you know. They maybe have left the fellowship of some group they thought was not right, and they have identified on paper that they think this is right, and they have taken the step into thin air to go and see and verify for themselves, and they come in the door with all their sensors up, and does someone take them and make them feel warm and wanted and desirous of coming back and becoming a part or not? I'll take a moment just to give you this one example. I had this one fellow in one of my congregations who was a royal pain in my neck. He wanted to be a deacon. He'd been around long enough, he should have been, but there's no way. He wanted to be in charge of this. He wanted to be in charge of that. The problem was, every time I'd give him an opportunity, he and his wife, within sometimes 30 minutes, but usually for sure by the end of the project, they would have so many people mad at each other and them. Sometimes they'd have women, potluck, you know, they'd have women stomping out of the kitchen in tears. And I'm thinking, you know, so I'd chew them out and I'd say, you know, this is ridiculous. And then they'd, oh, I'm sorry, you know, but I really, let me serve. So 6 months later, I'd say, well, okay, do this, you know. And do another. And I mean, in one sense, I'm being facetious, one could say they were worthless. I just couldn't use them. They were, you know. So, unbeknownst to me, these people were doing something else. They would look for new people. And I would say usually within 3 weeks, they would have drugged these people home. Just put them at their family table. All the things that happened when they were in charge of something didn't happen. Instead, you know, I was never there, but it must have been good. Because I'd be counseling these PMs. And they'd want to talk about baptism or something. And I'd say, well, now, you know, this is important to understand, the spiritual principle. Let's talk about that, you know. And they'd say, oh, no, I don't know about that. Oh, I was over at Mr. So-and-so's for lunch, and we were talking about tithing, and so-and-so was there, and, oh, that was interesting. They explained, and, well, we understood about, yeah. And I had a question about how to keep the Sabbath. I'd go visit someone else. I had a question about how to keep the Sabbath. But, you know, about a month ago, I was over at Mr. So-and-so's for lunch after church, and I think, good night, this guy's doing my counseling for me after church around his table. But, you know, it was always positive, and people were always turned on, and I began to tune into what was going on. Even more interesting than that, if I can digress on a digression, a year or so later, 2 years maybe, here comes other PMs, I'm talking with them, and I said, well, now, you know, you need to understand this. And he says, oh, I understand that. Mr. So-and-so, who happened to be the guy that told me 2 years ago that this original Mr. So-and-so had him over. Now it's the guy he had over is having people over. This guy spun off a cadre of people who were so appreciated, just felt that was the right thing, never discussed, never formalized, but he had this cadre, and I looked. When I first came, he was inviting Mr. A, B, and C. You know, I heard about them being over and learning these things. We baptized them. 2 years later, the original so-and-so, his grown son, and Mr. A, B, and C were all five. I was running into people that, oh, we've been over at their house, and we had a nice after Sabbath, da da da. And these people they're coming in the door, and they're staying. I mean, there's obviously were coming in the door, most of them, because they were drawn. But they were staying. Now, what I've read here, even though there's warmth and love and fellowship, is not going to be meaningful to someone God is drawing unless it is projected to them. That is redemption and lift. A benign form, but it will halt the growth of the church. And I firmly believe that a major aspect of PT lectures where people come and they come to church and they don't stay is attributable to this. I'll let you think it over and see if you see that in your area or not. He goes on to say, again, this is often unconscious, but outsiders soon get the message and will not stay around the church very long under those conditions. There are other causes as well. An undue stress on Christian perfection can turn a congregation into spiritual navel-gazers who are so pleased with their own heroic attainments that they have little tolerance for newer Christians who are not as polished. I think we've stumbled into that trap from time to time as well. They're somewhat like middle-aged couples who detest the thought of changing diapers and all that goes with having children, so they carefully practice birth control to avoid that possibility. Again, a congregation full of bickering and backbiting also becomes very self-centered. I think that those who have taken some of the doctrinal changes and just insisted on bickering and fostering or being part of a a frustrated, stress-laden atmosphere in a congregation, that congregation is not going to grow. And wounded people are not going to get well in that congregation. So he goes on to say, full of bickering, backbiting, also becomes very self-centered. So much energy is spent on trying to hold the internal pieces together and to survive that little attention is given to winning the lost. Even if some were won, they would not find there an atmosphere for healthy Christian growth and would likely shop around for a more satisfying church home. Worse yet, they might end up spiritual orphans. That's a sad commentary, you know. Even the people that have left God's church, statistically, if we look back at the various groups that have spun off the church and the people who've left and where are they now, 3, 5, 10 years later, a whole portion, a whole segment of them are spiritual orphans that left the church in the vehicle of some particular dissident group, but in time, because when you shut off the wholeheartedness the first time in order to justify yourself out the door, it's a lot easier to shut it off the second and the third. And eventually, well, you know, a lot of you, maybe I shouldn't use names, but I ran into one fellow a few years ago that was very well known to a large group of you, a fellow classmate of Chris's, I believe, and my brother, you guys in Brickett Wood. Successful, went into the ministry, you know. I was with Mr. Blackwell. We were having lunch, and this guy walked through the hotel. And Mr. Blackwell says, hey, you know, hi. And he came over, oh, hi. And he said, of course, it didn't take too long before Mr. Blackwell got around to, when are you coming back to church? And he got this look, and he says, well, he mentioned his wife's name. She'd be familiar, too. He said, so and so and I, he says, you know, we really enjoyed and we really appreciated our time in Worldwide. He said, he'd already said he wasn't part of any church. But he said, you know, he said, we needed it then. But he says, we've kind of come to the place where we've just kind of outgrown religion. I thought, what a pity. You know, where did we go wrong? Anyway, we don't want to create spiritual orphans, but these factors at play can lead to that. Whether they're of our own origin or whether people coming in from the outside that simply are not nurtured and brought into the fold, helped to become responsible Christians, which is what, remember, our strategic definition of making a disciple is. So he says, but suppose that the pastor and the lay leaders all do want the church to grow. The faith must be there. But as the Epistle of James asserts, faith without works is dead. In that light, then, I expand my former statement to say that the indispensable condition for a growing church is that it wants to grow and is willing to pay the price for growth. That's really the essential good, as I see it, of the open house program that we're working on and that we just had this training session. And if you all were to adopt any of the principles, the thing is that at the beginning, there's at least a six-month preparation period where a pastor and a congregation essentially come together in covenant whether or not they want to grow enough to pay the price. And the paying the price many times is changing themselves. We can have PT lectures all we want, and if we do not change ourselves to eliminate these blockages, well, we may bring people to the door, but they're not going to come in and stay. I have much more, but I will stop now by leaving you with one interesting graph that's applicable only to you. You want to turn this other mic on? Bruce is trying to do it all. He's only got 2 feet, 2 arms. Are we on yet? Okay. You want to kill the slide? Oops, wrong scale. This is a graph that will show that shows the. Now, this is not Assemblies of God. I think this is Church of Christ. So obviously, they differ greatly from us. But the organization of the Churches of Christ had a seminar, sponsored a seminar to come over and give them some of the principles. These are just the basics, the starting point, some of the principles that we've discussed today. They had two of them. They had a beginning, a basic seminar, and they followed it up a year later, or 2 years later, 1 year later, with an advanced seminar. Can you hear me okay? Okay.
I want to just show you. What are we doing here? Oh, just help us, buddy. Oh, that'll do. You can see the direction of the lines. This is 1966. You can see that up to 75 is where the first seminar. The top line is Victoria. The next one is South Australia. Third one is New South Wales. Fourth one is Queensland. And the bottom one is West Australia. You can see their lines were all going in roughly a similar direction. They begin to apply some of these principles. And you can see there was an almost immediate turnaround. They had an advanced seminar. And they learned some of the other principles. And they began to apply those, and you see that the upswing continued and has continued. I don't know what it is at the moment, but it has continued at a much higher level than it was before. Their decadal growth rate prior was minus 9.5%, which means at the end of 10 years, if they stayed like that, they would have lost roughly 10% of their membership. Their growth rate in those 2 years projected over the decade was plus 303%. I have another chart that makes this one look like looking insignificant. The direction of the change is so dramatic, I wasn't able to pirate it, so I don't have it to show you. But it was the result of a seminar given by the pastor of the largest church in the world, named Paul Yongji Cho, in Korea. He came down here to Australia. The downlines, this was Assemblies of God that he talked to, the downlines were even lower than that, pretty abysmal. He gave them some of these principles, and he said to them, they said to him that they didn't think they had any validity, and all kinds of reasons. He was so frustrated, but he said, "Look," he said, "I'm going to ask you to do one thing." He said, "I'll waive my fees." He said, "I just want to ask you to do one thing." He said, "I want you to take these principles," and he said, "I want you to take your faith," and he said, "I want you to project that faith outward into a measurable and physical form by setting some goals." He said, "If you do nothing else," he said, "project some reasonable goals forward." He said, "I'll come back in 1 year on my own expense. We'll talk about it." So they agreed they would do that much. He made them covenant and all this kind of stuff like they do. And they did. And you should, the change was dramatic. Now, what am I saying, that this is our salvation out of a flat line? No, I'm not. Am I saying that these are profound, in every case, spiritual things? In some cases, I hope you've seen they have a spiritual basis, soundly rooted in Scripture. At the same time, they are physical strategies. Obviously, the growth comes from God. He makes disciples. He determines where he wants to draw or not. We do not make that ultimate determination. However, I want to leave you, and I want us to understand that we can certainly hinder it, and we can halt it, or we can work with it, and thereby enable the crop to be that, bring in as a harvest a much greater crop. So I hope you found this helpful. There's another whole segment that I would like to give you, but we'll save it for next year. So if your question right now is, "Yeah, but I'm only one guy and maybe one assistant, and this is a huge job. How do we go about doing it?" Don't ask me that. That's the rest of the afternoon. But there are answers. We'll see you later.